Welcome to The Science Line. I'm Scott.
And I'm Risa. We're here to learn about the science that's happening here in our Idaho community, but we're also challenging scientists who dare to come on our show to think about how they communicate their research to people who know nothing about it, but whose tax dollars are funding it, like us.
But we're not going to take it easy on our guests. They will have to pay for their communication faux pas, like using ridiculous and unrelatable science terms and jargon, and they better not bore us. Based on how well they do, we'll assign them written homework in the form of lines. Hopefully, this will remind them of their blunders and what not to do next time.
Geez, take it easy, Scott. No one's going to want to come on our show if you keep carrying on like that.
Risa, are you ready for another episode of The Science Line?
I always am. But Scott, before we get started, we both have some exciting news to share.
Yeah, so I've been accepted to study for a PhD at the University of Tennessee, and I'm actually going to be studying scientific communication in the School of Journalism.
That's so exciting. And I've accepted an assistant professor position at Hastings College in Nebraska.
Well, congratulations on your new job.
Thank you.
But this might all mean that The Science Line is now listed as an endangered radio show.
I know, it's so sad. And our final episode is scheduled to air on Friday, May 21st.
Yeah, but we can't get too nostalgic quite yet.
Not yet. We still have a few episodes left.
Yeah, we got to hold it together. But while we're on the subject of scheduling, I want to just mention that next week, The Science Line is going to be at a special time of 11:30 a.m. because there's a conflict with the women's softball game.
Oh, I'm so glad you know what's happening, Scott.
Yeah, what would you do about me?
I know. What are we kicking the show off with this week?
Well, I want to go back to our roots and talk some more about science communication. Specifically, I want to re-ask some of the key questions. So what are the goals of scientific communication? Who are we communicating with? And why do we see it as so important?
Those are such great questions, but I hope you're not going to ask them all to me.
Well, lucky for you, Risa, I've actually already asked Google Scholar. And I found a paper published in the Public Understanding of Science journal, and it suggests that science communication has five key aims. The first is to increase awareness of important issues. The second is for public enjoyment. The third, for public interest. Fourth, to inform opinion. And finally, to increase understanding of important topics.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, but it seems a little bit one-dimensional to me. Mm-hmm. All of those goals seem to suggest that there is a one-way transmission of information about science from experts to the public. But as we know, there can be very important conversations and collaboration between the public, experts, and decision makers. And this adds a beautiful layer to science communication.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm so glad you brought that up. It was only a few weeks ago that we had Dr. Kate Reedy on the show talking about indigenous communities and how we can learn a lot from their culture, particularly around environmental management. So, you know, it's good to know you've been paying attention to the series.
Right. We know science communication is evolving. And as you mentioned, some of our previous guests have talked about how there's a lot of interesting research going on about how various factors can impact the effectiveness of science communication.
Exactly. So just to name a few, we know that context is really important. For instance, you might need to tailor your communication strategies if you're at a conference or giving a TED talk or just explaining your science to family or friends.
Right.
Also, we know that language is really important. We know that we have to choose the appropriate language for the appropriate audience. We know that overly technical jargon is a bit of a turnoff for the public.
I think it's a real turnoff. Yeah.
And we've even heard from Dr. Macbeth about how scientists are actually beginning to translate their work into a narrative or a story. And that can be really beneficial in getting the public to engage with what can be sometimes quite boring or complex topics.
Right, or they can seem that way if not presented well, right?
Exactly.
And so the field of science communication has recognized that we as humans have inherent biases in how we select and interpret information about science. This is a phenomenon defined as cognitive heuristics, and some researchers are even investigating ways to harness our biases in ways that are conducive to successful communication efforts.
Yeah, definitely. But don't you think this all sounds a little bit theoretical? And I was wondering, in your opinion, what are some of the practical applications of all these techniques we've been discussing throughout the show? You know, for instance, if there's a fellow scientist out there listening, what would be your advice to them to improve their scientific communication?
Yeah, you know, all of this research can seem a little bit theoretical and trivial, but it can definitely help sharpen our communication skills and build our toolbox, right? So for instance, most scientists now have a professional social media account. So if a scientist is creating an Instagram post about their research, they might try to use some of the language techniques in the caption, for example, not using technical jargon.
Yeah, yeah.
Or if they're writing a blog about their laboratory research, they might be able to build in a narrative strategy. It's all about selecting the right tool for the job.
Yeah, so you think it's really about just building that toolbox. That's a cool way of thinking about
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Awesome. And I think you also made a really good point earlier about actually scientific communication being a two-way process, where scientists need to learn from the public and other non-traditional forms of knowledge. But for this to happen, scientists need to be open to that, and they need to appear approachable to members of the public.
Absolutely.
Risa and I are pleased to be joined in the studio by Dr. Steve Lawyer, Professor of Clinical Psychology here at ISU. And actually, Steve recently won an Outstanding Researcher Award. So well done, Steve. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation.
Just before you got here, Steve, Risa and I were talking broadly about science communication with the public and what empowers a scientist to be really good at communication. And I wondered how often you have to communicate your science with a non-expert audience.
That's a great question. I actually, whenever I have the opportunity to speak to the community or speak in a public forum, I try to take it because I think that talking about science and communicating the work that we do as scientists is incredibly important to connect the community to the work that's happening, because the findings that come out of science labs all over the world have a really critical impact on all of our lives, even though it might not be obvious to folks. And so I take every opportunity that I can, and I think it's really important to talk about it in a way that people can grasp. And you know, obviously the spirit of your show is that sometimes we talk a big game about talking about science, but we sometimes aren't as good at it as we would like to be.
Yeah, and we're going to put it to the test.
Sure, exactly.
All right.
So Scott and I were doing some research on you before the show, and I was reading your personal bio on the ISU website. And it's clear that you are very intelligent, but I could not get a good feel for what it is that you do from that. I was like, ooh, what is this word? Yeah, and what is that word?
The disclaimer is it doesn't take much to confuse you though, right, Risa?
So that's probably very true.
I guess our real question is, in a field that's very complicated like yours, how do you try to avoid some of this technical language and jargon that might work to confuse a layperson or the general audience?
I think it's a great question. I mean, one of the things about psychology that's both a blessing and a curse is that it's really relevant to the things that we all do. And some of the language that psychologists use is consistent with the community in general. Mm-hmm. But we also have to talk to each other as professionals and as scientists. And sometimes that language can veer off.
Sure.
And there can be a real disconnect. So it really depends on the audience that you're speaking to and what have you. And it makes me think I need to go review my bio. And,
I'm sure you're.
And have a look at that, because, you know, as a scientist and as a social scientist, it's important to me. I want people to understand what it is that I do. But I also don't want them to get too caught up in the weeds, because there's a lot of weeds in what we do. And that's part of what scientists do, is they deal with all the minutiae and they deal with all the weeds. Yeah. And to try to communicate that, I think, is something that's really important.
I think the trouble is, it's almost like these fundamental defining terms, which you get so used to using when you use them every day.
Right.
You sort of stop and forget to realize that actually, like, if you're not in the field, then perhaps you wouldn't know what they are.
Right. And I'll point out, even by the way, the work that I do, even among scientists, what we're studying and what we call it is an evolving process. So broadly speaking, I study impulsive choice. And so impulsivity is something that we all understand, right? But as it turns out, it's way more complicated than that. And a recent paper just came out where they're basically making the argument that as a science, we need to get away from using the word impulsivity at all. Because it's because the way scientifically that we address it, it's just something that has come to mean so many things that it doesn't mean any one thing, you know, that it doesn't mean anything.
Right.
And so, but, you know, and that's for a bunch of nerdy scientists to work out, right? But the part of the science communication is taking that work and trying to package it into something that's accurate, but also meaningful. And that's a struggle sometimes.
I think we're going to hear about some really cool stuff today, Scott. And we will stop critiquing your bio and ask you, were you well behaved in school, or did you ever have to write lines on the board?
I was pretty darn well behaved in school. I was, you know, I sometimes am jealous of these, you know, kids who thought outside the box a bit more than me. And, but in general, I was well behaved. I won't say that there weren't a few low points in my early academic career, but generally, I was a pretty good kid.
So you never had to write lines then?
I never wrote lines in school, and so I'm looking. But I never had the experience, so I'm looking forward to the opportunity. Today.
Oh, good, yeah. Good.
And of course, for any of our new listeners, the whole reason we ask that is because at the end of the show, we like to dish out some lines based on how well you're able to communicate your science.
That's right. And so we understand that your research is about human behaviors, thinking about impulsivity, as you mentioned. And we want to assign you your line, which you'll need to try and recall at the end of the show. Okay. And so your line is, I will update my faculty bio so Risa can understand it.
Okay. All right. I'm committing to that as a mantra for this summer, Risa.
We really have been overly, like, it really isn't that bad. Like, it's totally fine.
No, I'm sure, like, to his fellow colleagues out there, they're like, this guy is exceptional.
Just our inadequacies.
Well, what you guys don't understand is the bigger words you use.
It makes you
less likely to be a victim, except when you come on a radio show, obviously.
Right.
Five letters or less is sort of a sweet spot for us. So without any further ado, let's get started with the first segment of the show, which is the Why Do We Care segment. This is when we give you 2 minutes to explain to us and to our listeners what you do as a scientist and why we should care. So the floor is yours. Good luck.
Thank you. Well, you know, broadly speaking, my research focuses on how decisions that people make in their day-to-day lives impact their health and their well-being. And a really critical factor in a broad range of human health problem behaviors, but especially things like sexual risk-taking, drug and alcohol use and abuse, obesity, is this tendency to make decisions that are based on short-term outcomes, what immediately happens, instead of the longer-term things that happen down the line after those decisions are made. And one of the frustrating realities about decisions that we make about our health is that, you know, the choices that we make have both immediate and delayed consequences. And a lot of times the immediate consequences feel great. Right? Mm-hmm. Sex feels great. Drugs feel great. Food tastes great. Mm-hmm. But if that were all there was to it, it wouldn't be an issue. But there tends to be a lot of longer term consequences down the line that really aren't so great. Sexually transmitted infections and unplanned pregnancies, obesity, a whole host of personal and professional and health related outcomes associated with drug use and abuse. But they tend to happen a little bit further down the line. And one of the things that we know is that people differ with regard to the extent to which they are sensitive to those immediate versus those delayed consequences. So there's individual differences, kind of a personality factor. But there's also environmental factors that can influence the extent to which anyone makes an impulsive decision. And so since studying a lot of these things in the real world is really complicated, not very feasible, we try to recreate these decisions in a laboratory environment. And so we bring people into the lab and we use what's called this delay discounting task, which simply asks people to make choices between a relatively small but immediate outcome. It might be money, it might be sex, it might be food, it might be drugs, or a larger but a delayed outcome. Mm-hmm. And when we can try to capture those patterns of behavior, it really helps us understand those patterns of behavior. And once you can understand a pattern of behavior, you can do things to help influence it, to either make it go up or make it go down. And those have really important social health implications for us individually, but also collectively. Right. And so if we can try to understand a behavior in the lab and how it's related to what happens out in the real world, can really give us some good guidance on how to intervene in an effective way.
I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. Our guest today is Dr. Steve Lawyer, Professor of Clinical Psychology here at Idaho State University. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us for questions and trivia on the Science Line.
Listen to KISU live on your home's Amazon or Google smart speaker by telling it, play KISU. This is KISU-FM, Pocatello, Idaho Falls, Rexburg.
We want to pause for a moment to let you know that you're listening to The Science Line. I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. Right now, we're going to jump back into our conversation with Professor of Clinical Psychology, Dr. Steve Lawyer. So, Steve, in your two-minute section there, you talked a little bit about something called discounting. So can you explain a little bit more about this and its relationship to impulsivity?
Right. That's a great question. So discounting or delay discounting is really one aspect of impulsivity. Impulsivity is actually a pretty broad phenomenon, and there's a lot of different behavior processes in there, and delay discounting is one of them. And it simply refers to the tendency to prefer smaller, sooner outcomes instead of larger, delayed outcomes.
So is that the classic, you know, you'd rather have £5 now than £50 in a year's time or whatever?
Exactly.
Wait, are you talking to your to your British mother?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. It's dollars, of course. Well, how could I?
Because I know she listens to the show. Yes. So I thought that was for her.
The good news is that actually translates behaviorally, because it doesn't matter. We know that discounting, whether it's pounds or dollars or bites of food or amount of sex or drugs, it all translates into the same thing. And so you simply ask people to make choices between, you know, $5 now and $100 in a month. And then you vary the dollar amounts and you vary the delays, and you can get a really lovely sort of pattern of behavior.
So I was trying to read a little bit about this, try and pretend to be prepared. And I was reading about the parabolic curve and how that can begin to explain our discounting. So how does that all play into this?
Well, first of all, Scott, it's hyperbolic.
So it's hyperbolic. Okay, well, obviously, shows I didn't read very much.
Parabolic? What are you talking about? No, I'm just kidding. It's called the hyperbolic decay function. It's simply really a theoretical model of how human choice operates in the delay discounting paradigm. But it actually matters in behavioral economics, because broadly this fits within the marriage of psychology and economic theory, which is behavioral economics, because the hyperbolic decay function that we call it really helps characterize the sort of the humanity that goes into decision making. Mm. And this tendency to the more delayed things are, the less of an impact they have on our behavior.
Oh.
So I guess it explains sort of things that appear strange to people who perhaps don't engage in them, like smoking. Seems like a crazy thing to do, but for people who do it, they perhaps just have a different discounting factor built into them.
Well, they do. And one of the things coming back to the hyperbolic model that really matters is there's a phenomenon that we all have experienced where there's what's called a preference reversal. Preference reversal is basically this. I'm going to start going to the gym tomorrow. We've all done this. I'm going to start going to the gym. I'm going to start eating better. And that starts tomorrow. And so we make that commitment to doing that right now. But then what happens as tomorrow starts to approach, we get this preference reversal where our preference changes as a function of how close we are to it. And so now all of a sudden it's like, well, maybe not today. Tomorrow for sure.
Yeah,
the next tomorrow is for sure, right?
Yeah.
And so that mathematical model factors into that tendency to change our mind, to change our commitment when the rubber hits the road.
We were reading an example about money and how if you offered to give somebody $50 today or $100 in 3 months, most people would choose $50 today, right? Because they have the assurance they're going to receive the $50 today and it's instant gratification.
Right.
But if you offered $50 to somebody, let's say in a month versus $100 to somebody in 3 months, most people would then choose the $100 in 3 months.
Exactly. You guys really did your research.
Yes.
Well done. And that's the behavioral economics. That's the psychology of it, where these delays to these outcomes really have important influences on
our
the choices
decision.
That we make. On the decisions that we make and the choices that we make, which have a lot of potential impact on health outcomes and financial outcomes for that matter.
But we know people exhibit different levels of discounting.
Right.
And Scott came up with this ludicrous example about us, and we're hoping that you might be able to explain our different choices.
Okay, so the scenario is Risa and I are both given tickets to a dodgy skydiving company. They have a 1 out of 5 safety rating.
Okay.
And we calculate that we roughly have a 1 in 100 chance of death if we go skydiving with these people because they have holy parachutes. And we have to make the decision, are we going to go skydiving? And I decide that actually I'm going to take that risk and go for it. Risa, on the other hand, much more sensible, decides that she doesn't want to go skydiving. Now, what are some of the factors that might have impacted my choice to go skydiving and perhaps Risa's choice not to?
Wow. It's a great example of not only does delay influence the choice that we make, but also the likelihood or the probability of good or bad things happening. And so in terms of the things that might contribute to that, so we've been talking about delay discounting, but probability discounting is also another related phenomenon as well. And there's all kinds of life experiences that might play a role in that. We know that there are some genetic factors that go into our tendency to make choices that are impulsive. But there's also a lot of life and contextual and environmental and developmental factors that play a role as well.
Or perhaps, like, maybe I knew somebody that had been slightly injured in a skydiving accident, which might have prevented me from wanting to take that risk, right?
I feel like there's never a slight skydiving injury.
Well, as someone who has been skydiving, I get it's sort of a, it's one or the other. Things go really well or things go really poorly, right?
Yeah, exactly. That would,
Okay.
So I'm wondering, is this process of discounting, is it a desirable characteristic?
Wow, that's a really great question, Risa. It's one of those things where we oftentimes talk about these processes in the context of really bad things, you know, like health risk behaviors. And I think that's important because we're trying to do things to improve the human condition and try to offset bad things that happen in people's lives. And I think that's really important. But I think it's sometimes a mistake to pretend like those phenomena are always negative because they're not. Because sometimes being impulsive pays off. Because sometimes choosing that $50 now instead of the $100 in a month, something might happen where that $100 is not available. Mm-hmm. And so making the quote-unquote impulsive choice actually might be the right one.
Might have benefited you.
Exactly. It's a strike while the iron's hot sort of a phenomenon. And this is actually related to some of the research that we're doing in our lab looking at what's called the poverty mindset and trying to understand financial decisions that they make in their own lives that might seem short-sighted, but in the context of people's lives, sometimes making that short-sighted decision, they don't have the option of waiting for that delayed larger outcome because life hasn't provided those opportunities for them to be around for that long. And so sometimes it is the impulsive choice, but it's the necessary choice.
Right.
And so we have to remember that as well.
So can you apply your PhD and expertise in discounting to this idiom, don't count your chickens before they hatch?
Let me think about, it's funny, you hear these idioms and it's, oh, I've heard that a million times. And let's think about how that actually applies.
Because doesn't it seem to suggest that we shouldn't discount at all? If we shouldn't count our chickens before they hatch, it's implying that discounting is actually a very bad behavior.
So if we're not counting our chickens before they hatch, I think it would sort of suggest that we don't make a decision based on an outcome that we don't,
that's not for certain.
Yet, right?
Yes.
That's not for certain.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so in that case, it's sort of a bird in the hand is better than two in the bush sort of a thing, right? And so from a discounting perspective, it's like take that bird in the hand because if you let that go, so I'm going to change idioms on you because that's convenient for me. but if you don't hold on to that bird in the hand and if you focus on the two in the bush, you might be left with nothing at all.
It's so funny that you use that idiom.
We came across that.
I spent probably an hour and a half yesterday trying to remember that idiom. And I kept saying all this stupid stuff like, an elephant in the field is worth 6 in the watering hole or whatever. You know, it's like pointless stuff like that.
He was going through like all these idioms. And I'm like, I don't think that's quite right.
I don't see it. That's not hitting the right note for me.
Oh, man.
Oh,
And so, yeah, but we thought, like, oh, some of these idioms kind of relate to what you do.
They sure do.
We should transition to trivia, though, Risa, because we are going to
the most important part of the show.
Exactly, exactly. So, all right, I'll kick things off. And we've talked about this idiom, don't count your chickens before they hatch, and how it's related to discounting. So my question is, what percentage of chicken eggs actually hatch?
So I'm going to point out, I actually have backyard chickens, and I don't hatch them though. Oh. So what percentage of chicken eggs actually hatch?
If you incubate them. Yeah.
I'm going to go 70%.
Oh, right. Whoa, on the money.
Yes. Yeah.
70% of chickens will probably hatch if you incubate them.
All right. My question is, what is the probability of getting a double yolk egg?
Can you see the theme here?
It's going to be very low. And so I'm just going to go 2%.
2%. It's actually 1 in 1,000.
Which is what?
Okay.
0.1%? Who can do the math?
Yep. It's 0.1%.
You're confused then. I'm going to point out, even in my heart when I said 2%, I'm like, this seems even way too high. Yeah.
Yep. So 1 in 1,000, right. Not 2 out of 100. So you could, though, end up with an entire carton of double yolk eggs like a British man did in 2016.
What an event.
I know. And seriously, Scott will appreciate this. There is something called the British Egg Information Service that cracks open cases on unusual egg yolk sightings.
That is just awful. Because we were reading, there was a story about this guy who, he got a double yolk and then a triple yolk. And it was so statistically unlikely, they called in like an Oxford University professor to come and do the math on it. And it was like 1 in 1,000,000,000,000 likelihood.
Right, right.
That exactly. He got these.
Well, that's the law of large numbers for you, though. If you think about how many eggs are consumed all over the world, right?
Right.
You know, even low probability events, you know, when you're talking about something that happens at such frequency.
Exactly. There are a huge number of eggs in the world, and that we have actually armed that statistic.
We do in our next segment, which is your assignment of lines. And so we have to assign how many lines you are going to get. And do you remember? I feel like you remember your line.
It's going to be close.
Yeah.
So I believe that I commit to changing my bio so that Risa can understand.
Exactly.
It.
That's so good. You have it. Well, you did so well today, Stephen. It was so fun talking to you about what you do and thinking about these decision-making processes that we all go through as humans. Mm-hmm. And so, Scott, how many lines do you think Steve should get?
Well, I was thinking that I should give you 122 billion lines.
And he did want lines.
Yeah, because that is the estimated number of chicken eggs that will hatch this year. But we think you did really well, so that seems pretty harsh.
We did, and we don't want to count our chickens before they've hatched. So we're just going to count the ones that have hatched this year so far, which is about 40 billion. So you can work on this.
Yeah. We are at the end of the semester. I've got all summer.
Yeah, exactly.
You do. Yeah. Plenty of time.
Plenty of time. And before we lose you as well, we just wanted to thank you because we know you're a sustaining member of KISU, and this week is our pledge drive week, and I wonder if you could tell our listeners why you feel it's important to donate to the station.
Absolutely. I've been a longtime sustaining member of KISU. I'm a big supporter of college radio in general, but KISU in particular, because I think it's really important to have a connection to the world around us and provide to the community, whether it's the ISU community or the Southeast Idaho community, a connection to the larger world around us. And KISU has always done such an amazing job along those lines. And so I'm happy to continue my support, and I hope others do the same.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much. And if you want to donate, you can go to KISU.org and click on the donate button. But from Risa and I guess that's the end of this episode. And thanks very much for listening.
Thank you for joining us today on The Science Line. If you're interested in being on the show, please contact us at thescienceline@isu.edu.